Welcome to the 2019 Healing with Horse Telesummit. Each year we gather leaders and practitioners to teach and share their learning, methods, and best practices. This session is part of a series of educational audio sessions that are available at healingwithhorse.org. I'm your host, Deidre West. And today we have psychotherapist and New Yorker, Eva Yusadi. And I've chosen this year's speakers from among the major healers and supporters who helped me through cancer and my related health crises. Eva offered two things. One was to research and advocate for me to acquire health insurance. And then she very delicately offered to support my horses should I need to find new homes for them. And both of these things, what I also loved about what she did is, you know, when I said no, she listened to my no and respected that. So there was just a lot of walking your talk and just a great energy about it. Today, Eva's going to talk about the concept of moral injury in working with combat veterans. We'll also then discuss a more broad-reaching issue, existential crisis, in the people we serve in our equine practice. Welcome, Eva.
Thank you, Deidre. Happy to be here.
And before we get started, let me tell you a little bit more about Eva. Eva Yusadi is the founder and executive director of Trauma and Resiliency Resources, or TRR, and the clinical director of its award-winning Warrior Camp program. TRR's Warrior Camp is specifically designed to heal trauma and prevent suicide in military veteran populations by focusing on the moral injuries that are a natural consequence of combat operations. Eva is a GALA certified as a military service provider. She's a certified EMDR therapist and a registered yoga teacher. She has advanced training in sensorimotor psychotherapy and holds a certificate in traumatic stress studies from the Trauma Center in Boston. She holds a master's degree in existential phenomenological psychology. And in private practice in New York City, Eva specializes in the assessment and treatment of PTSD, complex PTSD, and moral injury. She is a contract therapist for the New York Fire Department, a TRICARE military one-source provider, and a preferred provider for Doctors Without Borders. Eva has taught and presented at numerous conferences in the United States, the UK, and Europe. She is the daughter of a World War II veteran. That's quite a bio, Eva. And so why don't you start us out by just giving us a brief history of really the clinical work you've done with the military and how you've come to learn what you have about what is going on with that population.
Sure. Thank you. Yeah, a lot of the work with the military was an outgrowth of work I did with the New York City Fire Department in the aftermath of 9/11. I was one of the people that was first on at Ground Zero working with all first responders from Fire Department, Police Department, Secret Service, FBI, et cetera. And through that, I ended up having a lot of firefighters see me in my private practice. And although they were, of course, working on what happened to them on 9/11 and many other traumatic incidents that had happened in their many years within the Fire Department, in 2004, after the war in Iraq started, or actually Afghanistan was first, some of my firefighters started to deploy, and I really had not understood at that point that they were also members of the National Guard and Reserves. And so as they started to go up to war, it sort of brought me right back to what my experience was during the Vietnam War, when a lot of my friends went and family members, and I thought, wow, here we go again. And I, you know, because of those experiences decades ago, I really didn't want to see this generation of military veterans either be, you know, ignored or misunderstood, or even worse than that in some cases. And so I, you know, began to develop a connection with different military organizations, including the New York National Guard and some others. And then I had the great privilege of being able to work at a military base for almost 8 months in 2007-2008. I was at Fort Drum, which is the home of the 10th Mountain Division of the U.S. Army. So I had a real hands-on experience with what happens to soldiers when they go to war and then return home. And it became pretty clear that even though on base I was seeing some of my soldiers several times a week and for extended periods of time, that was really not enough.
just like it wasn't enough with fire and police that I worked with after 9/11, that something more intense and different had to happen to be able to help them through the level of trauma that they had experienced. It was really at Fort Drum that this idea of a week-long program came to fruition in my mind. And that happened to be what turned out to be the last year of my father's life. And he was talking to me a lot about what I was noticing happening with these soldiers on base. And he was clearly very involved in what I was doing. And I recognized at some point during that year that he had unresolved trauma from his experience in World War II. But it didn't really fit in with PTSD. There was something else I was picking up on from him. And there was also something else that I was hearing in the soldiers' stories about what had happened to them. So it was from that experience and some other experiences I had had with fire and police after 9/11, where I had done kind of mini workshops where we had gone away for, you know, 3 or 4 days, and we had done intensive EMDR and yoga and a couple of other things. And it seemed to be an interesting and effective model, but it also felt like there was a missing component. And then I discovered a herd of horses and had my own personal experience, and boom, that was the missing piece of what needed to happen, you know, in a more intensive program. And so that's how the Warrior Camp program developed. TRR initially was set up as an online resource for New York City's first responders so that they could be directed toward more quality care. But when the war started and things became, you know, sort of different in my mind about what needed to happen and what kind of response was necessary from a clinical perspective, that's when I started having ideas about actually going operational and doing programs. And so it took quite a while to get the first program off the ground. We did our first week-long program in 2013. But it had been in development for a while, and it took a lot of thought and careful planning to get the right team together to do this kind of program where we're all living together, and they were going, the participants were going from one modality to the next in a period of a week so that we could touch on every aspect of the trauma that they had experienced during deployment.
When you said that when you experienced horse therapy or as a herd of horses, and then you said, boom, that was it. What was it? Is there any way you can maybe describe what you were seeing or feeling or that you knew would somehow be the key for them?
I bumped into a herd of horses that did something for me personally that was unlike anything I'd ever experienced before. And I ended up going home. I met a bunch of horses in a field. I was on my way to a riding lesson. And, you know, something happened with these horses that were all at liberty in their paddock, and they touched me on such a deep level in terms of the way they were with me like that I thought, wow, there's something to this. And I went home and I did a Google search. This was in 2006, about horses healing people. I didn't even know what I was asking, but I knew that something yeah. really profound huh. had shifted inside of me. And so I, you know, found Igala, I found Epona, I found Path, I found all of these, you know, opportunities. And by the end of the summer, I had gotten myself certified through Igala because it just hit me on such a deep level, and I really got what this was about. And this is the missing piece of my own life as a therapist. This is what I want to do. This is a whole different level of healing, and I kind of get it. I can't do anything with a client that I don't actually know works for me personally. And this was the piece of the program I was conceptualizing that was going to really just add, you know, a whole different dimension and a whole different component, in part because of the movement. I mean, it's very much about how beautiful horses are and what they add and how intuitive and how expressive and all of that. But it's also being able to move and move through things, because that's what has to happen with trauma resolution. People have to move through their trauma, and physically doing right. it is a really big deal. So it kind of rounded out what I was thinking I wanted to do in a real program that I was developing.
Well, there's a lot you're saying here. For one, I'm just going to point out what I'm seeing, and maybe you can respond to this. So one, it seemed to me that the horses, it was a calling. This was your moment of calling into this kind of work. It seems like everyone has that moment, whether it's a dream or an experience with horses. And for you, it was that moment with the herd, which I know is critical to your work with horses, is working within the herd. And then two, you're talking about moving through the trauma and it being both a movement and a movement through. I don't know if you want to say anything about that yet, I mean now, or if you want to start talking about moral injuries.
I think talking about moral injury might be, a good way to go right now, and we can certainly come back to this piece of what moving through trauma really entails, because I think it is important, and it's one of the things that differentiates what we do in the arena with horses, because in our offices, we're pretty stationary. Even if we're moving around in the office, we're still in a very confined space and mostly sitting. And that just doesn't work for me anymore. but yeah, I'd like to talk about moral injury because I think it's really important.
Well, it's going to be key maybe to how you move too. Tell us about moral injury.
Well, we ran our first Warrior Camp program in November of 2013. And then in the midst of that program, we're already being registered for the next program. And so we just kind of moved into really rapid-fire work unexpectedly. I didn't know that would happen so quickly. And what happened at the next program, which was January of 2014, that was our second program, of all the participants who came, all but three were combat medics. And of the three who were not combat medics, one was a military chaplain who had deployed four times, twice to Iraq, twice to Afghanistan. And there was something so significant about this particular program that caused my entire clinical team to take a step back and say, wow, what is going on here? This really means something that combat veterans or combat medics are presenting with this level of trauma, but kind of trauma plus. There's something else here. And what we learned from listening to their stories is that it was really, they had joined whatever branch of service they joined because they wanted to serve, but they wanted to serve in a capacity where they would be healing wounds, literally and figuratively. And so they were trained, and they found themselves in many instances, both in Iraq and Afghanistan, of being in the field, treating a wounded soldier, and then having to pick up their weapon and fire back because they were under attack. And so they would shoot a combatant and then realize that they were now in a position to actually treat the combatant they had just shot. And this dissonance between what they thought they were going to do and what actually happened to them in the heat of battle was something that they were really struggling to come to terms with. I understand I joined the armed forces. I meant it. I did it on purpose, but I really didn't expect to be killing people. That wasn't what I thought my MOS is, like the special thing that you decide you're going to do within the military. There are lots of jobs, and, they thought theirs was to heal wounds,
right. Theirs
not
was
to
healing and helping
them.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. And many of the people that came to that program, as in the first program, had been struggling with suicide and had made attempts in the past. So we thought there had to be a connection between this dissonance between how I see myself and who I think I am and what I've just done.
Right.
That, if not addressed, is really unable to be processed. That there really needs to be some help to process that. And the striking thing, which I'm not sure I've spoken about much, is that what I learned from this military chaplain, who I've had many, many interactions with through the years, is that military chaplains are expected to take care of other people, and they get no care themselves. And not only that, their task is not what we think it would be, which is to counsel people spiritually and, all the things that we think about clergy doing. Their task is actually to keep people combat ready. And so they work in an environment which creates dissonance because, it's like, take a knee, get back on the battlefield. And so, there's so many levels of dissonance that I think that that's the key piece that is really outside of the PTSD diagnosis. It really doesn't have that much to do with PTSD.
Right, yeah, exactly. I can see that.
Yeah, it's the hidden piece of trauma, or especially combat trauma, because there's so much death and killing that we think that that has to be looked for, not just noticed, but actually sought out, because if we don't ask for it, it's not going to appear.
This is interesting. When I started working in healing settings with horses back in 2001, I think it was, or 2000, somewhere in there, I was working with people with severe PTSD ever since Vietnam. And the thing I remember this one guy kept saying, and he was diagnosed with severe PTSD, but he kept saying, you know, I had to kill these old, you know, this guy, he was an old man, the guy was a sniper. And it was always about that. It was always about these people he killed, different ones, and how they had just been the elders of the villages, or were just old men going out to go to the restroom or in the middle of the night because they knew they might get taken out. And finally they go outside, and then sure enough, he does take them out. Those were his stories. But I did think, gosh, that seems like a strange story for PTSD, which is, other than the fact that there was clearly this link between the past and now, you know. Yeah, so how did you find the concept?
Yeah, we didn't quite know what we were looking at, but because I've done a lot of reading, you know, I'm not a veteran, I haven't served myself and won't. I'm, you know, I've aged out of that possibility. But I, you know, I've done a lot of reading, and Jonathan Shea, who was a VA psychiatrist during the Vietnam War, wrote a couple of books in which he used this term, and he actually probably was the one who coined this term, moral injury. And he really talked about all of these experiences that veterans had in Vietnam that were haunting them and that were really outside of the symptomatology of PTSD. So that's, you know, I started reading more and more and then talking to people about this other thing that I was feeling that really felt like an existential or spiritual wound. And every veteran that I talked to about this said, that's it. That's it. That's what's wrong with me. How come nobody has ever asked me about this before? And so there was a lot of confirmation from people that we were working with and also people I knew in the community. And in fact, a couple of weeks ago, I was walking down the street in Greenwich Village, New York City, and I hear my name being called, and I turned around, and it was an old friend, one of the trainers from my gym, who I hadn't seen for a while, and he was just, you know, how are you doing? What's going on? He's wearing his army jacket and, you know, hat. He served in Somalia. He was in the Mogadishu incident, and you know, we hadn't talked about that for quite some time, but all of a sudden, standing on the street, he's talking about how people through the years have suggested that he go to therapy. I mean, he was involved in this conversation because he knows what I do, and he's been following us online, and so he's been very supportive and, you know, very enamored of the work that I'm doing with veterans. And he said, yeah, people for years, they kept saying, you know, you probably have some stuff, you need to go, you know, talk to VA about it. And, you know, maybe of PTSD. And he always resisted that. And he said, the reason I resisted is because it's not about what happened to me. My problem is what I did. Mm. And he said, you're spot on when you're talking about this moral injury, because it's always about what we did. That stays with us. The other stuff is really different. This is the key. He was just saying, you know, right on, you know, you're doing the right thing. And then he launched into the whole thing about horses and, you know, how wonderful it is that we're not riding them in our program. And, you know, I looked at him at one point and said, will you go on the air with me? You know, this conversation is like spontaneous. And he just went right into his, you know, description of his moral injury and why, you know, going to regular treatment for PTSD was not going to address that.
So maybe you can go into some of the things we would look for that help us know we're seeing moral injury.
Well, would it be okay before I do that if I define it? Would that be helpful?
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, TRR has a very expansive definition, but I'm going to tell you a shortened one that whenever I screen people for the program, I ask them, you know, are you familiar with the concept of moral injury? And some say, what? And some say, yeah, yeah, I've heard of that. And about a year and a half ago, one of the guys said, yeah, I've heard of that, and I think I know what it is, and I asked him. And he said, this is a quote, oh, that's when you're ordered to do what you were raised not to do, but you had to do it because it was an order and because lives were at stake.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what we're talking about. Now, TR has a slightly expanded definition where, you know, we consider moral injury an existential and or spiritual crisis that can be the consequence of having been trained to override the intrinsic aversion to the taking of human life. We think it's very much about killing. It can also be the consequence of having engaged in combat operations, however necessary at the time, that violate one's own moral or ethical code. And one of the key veterans who's really been doing a lot of writing about moral injury and has, he actually, a conversation with him was what helped me understand the second piece of that, that it's not, yes, the killing is significant, but it's also the way we engage with the civilian population and combatants that really can be damaging. And the way that he said it, this is Tyler Boudreau, who wrote The Morally Injured and some other pieces. And the way he says it, this is a quote, he says, "Moral injury is about the damage done to our moral fiber when transgressions occur by our own hands, through our orders, or with our connivance. When we accept these transgressions, however pragmatically, for survival, for instance, we sacrifice a piece of our moral integrity."
Hmm.
So if you think about...
Damned if you do, and you have to. There's
exactly.
No damned if you don't. You have to.
Exactly. And when you think about, you know, that most of the people that we send to war, not all, but certainly the vast majority, are barely out of being teenagers, 19, 20, 21 years old. They haven't even reached cognitive maturity yet. And now we're putting them in a position where they have to figure out how to live with these acts that most adults are never, ever going to experience, thankfully. So, you know, for many of them, it's just undoable.
Yeah, that's just a very poignant point, I think. I don't know what to say at that point.
See, I think that's beautiful that you just said that, Deirdre, because I think this is the reason that a lot of traditional therapy doesn't address this, because we don't know what to say. And the not knowing what to say is because we're so used to pigeonholing people into diagnosis. This is what's wrong with you. This is the treatment. You know, these are the symptoms. This is what it's called. This is what we're going to do. But when somebody comes into our office and says, and they generally don't volunteer this, but we hear it through the story, you know, "I'm evil. I've done wrong. I've sinned. I don't deserve to live because of what I did." Most of us, without understanding how to be different, you know, traditionally our thinking is, well, geez, you need to go talk to a priest. I can't deal with this. But we have to, because this is really what it's about. And, you know, as I said before, military chaplains don't really address this either. That's not what they're supposed to be doing, mostly. And so it's a very complicated, you know, they don't know so much about the psychology. We don't know so much about the spirituality. We think that's not our realm. And then we miss most of what is causing all of this disruption for people.
If you go back to the chaplain comments before, what the struggle was, I mean, in some ways you might think a chaplain could address this, except that they are so trained and they're tasked with the job of getting them back out there that, yeah, that's actually a different game than addressing a spiritual crisis, you know, something that goes against your moral code. You can't talk about that and then also send them back out. So that's kind of an interesting conundrum.
That's exactly it. And you can't talk about that and work for a system which requires people to kill. You can't,
right.
It's like you can't do both, but they have to do both. And so we're actually doing a dedicated program in June. We're doing a warrior camp for military chaplains. It is awesome. We're getting some real interest. I've wanted to do this for a few years, and, you know, it's now being put out there, you know, in a way that will attract as many people as we can, especially those who've been in combat zones. because they feel it even more intensely, you know, if they've actually deployed to a war zone and, you know, had to do, you know, a sermon for somebody who's died in battle and then send people right back out. And that's very complicated for them as human beings. So, yeah, we're excited about that program. I think it's past time that we do it.
Well, earlier you mentioned, what the key distinction is between PTSD maybe and moral injury. What about complex PTSD? You might need to start with defining that for some of us, but I know you're a specialist in complex PTSD. How is that distinguished from moral injury?
That's a really great question, and one of the reasons that I've started to talk about this more is that the VA has now, you know, taken up the banner of moral injury. They, you know, they talk about it more than they used to. And what I've seen in some of the PowerPoints that they've put out is PTSD and moral injury, and then in the middle they have all these common symptoms. And I think they've made a really serious theoretical mistake, because the common symptoms are actually complex trauma. And there is, even though this hasn't been accepted in mainstream psychology yet, it's been put out there for about 15 years, that complex PTSD is quite different than simple PTSD, because complex PTSD involves trauma of extended duration. These are the main differences. Trauma of extended duration, exposure to grotesque sights, sounds, and smells over extended duration, and it's interpersonal, meaning it's been inflicted on purpose by another person. And so, you know, I had an interesting conversation with a Marine veteran, a Vietnam veteran who was in the Marine Corps, and he was saying something about having been shot at, and I said, well, didn't you think that was personal? They were actually shooting at you. And he said, oh, wow, I never really thought about it that way. But, you know, especially snipers, they have somebody in there that they're targeting. That is quite personal. You know, I think that we need to separate that from moral injury, which is about something even beyond the complexity of those kind of interpersonal traumas, which have to do with, and this comes from the warriors themselves, you know, we're not kind of superimposing this on them. But when people talk about feeling that they've sinned, that doesn't really fit in traditional PTSD, either symptomatology or treatment. And so, you know, people feeling really evil inside, people feeling like they need to punish themselves because of what they've done. And we make it even worse when we give people awards and medals for things that they think they really don't deserve a medal for. And so, you know, they end up having to punish themselves. If we're not willing to punish them and they think they've done wrong, then they punish themselves. And ultimately, you know, we think that that is what is part of the suicide rate in the military population today, which is unfortunately on the rise, especially in special forces and active duty military. The suicide rate has actually gone up in 2018. So it seems like a really critical point of distinction. And the way that I look at it, having been in the field for 33 years and having many, many conversations with other clinicians and, you know, all kinds of conversation about this, is that you can only treat what you understand. And if you're missing something really big, then the treatment is not going to be as successful as it needs to be. And, you know, the other thing that Tyler Boudreau helped me understand, he's a very eloquent writer, is that another distinction between PTSD and moral injury is that PTSD is based on symptoms, which lead to a diagnosis, which lead to treatment, and it's very individual. You know, there's something seriously wrong with a human being, and we know that, even if they don't want to call it a disorder. A lot of veterans have dropped the D from, you know, they call it PTS. But clearly there's something wrong, and people are suffering. And there is treatment for that, including medication, in a lot of cases, can be helpful. But the difference is that moral injury is not just an individual dilemma. It's actually a problem that needs to be put back on a societal level. That, you know, PTSD has created mental patients among a lot of military veterans. And we think that moral injury is an ethical response to having done wrong, something that violates one of them's moral code, and that that actually is a higher level of being human. And that mm-hmm. needs to be, of course, processed, but respected and commended. And that this needs to be talked about among society, because we're the ones that send our young people to war. So we need to learn how to share the burden that they return home with, or they're not going to live. And we know that.
If we saw it that way, too, it's not a disorder or a pathology, but as a sign of the nobility of the human coming through and being injured by what's required. That's a key distinction to make. Nice articulation of that point.
Yeah, it puts the conversation on a different level. And, you know, it puts it on the level of, rather than diagnose people, let's enter into dialogue about what we have all done. Because they do these things in our name. It's not, you know, it's not about us. It is about us.
One thing that comes up to me when, as we talk about all of society, too, is that this concept of moral injury could be something that there'd be a temptation to say, well, I've been morally injured and so on. What makes this term key to you, and how would you want to distinguish it from other things? We're going to talk about existential crisis later. I think it'd be important to distinguish moral injury, as I know you do, from things that happen to a civilian, for example.
Well, I think that we have to in some way recognize that there's something really unique about serving in the military and being in a combat zone. And I just, you know, although PTSD started as being a diagnosis for Vietnam veterans and certainly was, you know, an improvement over, you know, diagnosing them with schizophrenia and with bipolar disorder because of their symptoms, it certainly is better than that. But, you know, it still becomes, as you said, individual pathology. And many people in the world have PTSD from all kinds of things. And so, you know, what I'm suggesting, and I'm not alone in this, is that there has to be something that distinguishes military service and what happens to people in that environment that's different than, you know, making a wrong decision at work and feeling that you violated your own ethics. Well, yeah, we've all probably done that on some level. But it's not really the same as killing someone. That's something you can't take back. Okay. You can't undo that. And you can't undo humiliating, you know, an Iraqi man in front of his wife and children in a culture which that's really unacceptable. And so, you know, those are acts that can't be undone. And I think some of the things that happen that are now being, you know, moral injury is becoming the new term for everything. And I just think there needs to be some distinctions made. And it may not be the best term. We may need to find a different term that really is more connected to military service and combat experiences. And maybe somebody will come up with a better term that's not all-encompassing, you know, because certainly ethical violations are ethical violations. But I think there needs to be some acknowledgement that there is something very different about being at war, and every veteran who has been to war will tell you that. And that's part of the isolation. Nobody gets what happened to me or what I did except my brothers.
So the distinction here is in the scope of the crime almost, to at least on a human level, a murder or a very violent or, as you said, humiliating someone in front of their family. But, yeah, it sounds like there's a scope issue. These are very large crimes, but not crimes because they're required and part of your job.
Exactly, and that's the societal piece. You know, that when we order somebody to do something, then it's not the same as being a crime. You know, we've legalized some horrible things, and
yeah,
that doesn't make them okay. And that's the problem, is that people know in their hearts that even though I was following a legal order, if what I did feels wrong to me in my heart and soul, it's still wrong.
Right.
So, you know, I think that's a little bit different than other kind of violations. I think, you know, police officers have something in common with military veterans because they're trained to kill, and they do. And they also have a very high suicide rate. So I think that there are you know, they may be in the same boat in terms of having a similar response to what they're trained and ordered to do. And then can't really come back from that very easily by themselves, and in some cases, not at all.
Eva, I don't know if you have these numbers on hand, but you did mention that the numbers of suicide rate had gone up in the study of 2018. Do you know what the numbers are, or can you give us a sense of what we're looking at?
I wish I had that. I don't have the numbers because in the report I read, which was put up by SOCOM, it's the Special Forces, Special Operations Command, they didn't give numbers, but it's a very disturbing rise because historically Special Forces, you know, Army Rangers, Green Berets, Navy SEALs, they have been less prone to suicide, but that has shifted in the last year in a very disturbing way. And the rise in active duty suicides is also quite disturbing because it had been down for a while. And any level of suicide among this population or anybody is of course disturbing. But, you know, part of what happens to Navy SEALs and the other special forces is that because they do things that they can never, ever, ever
talk about. Mm-hmm.
They keep it inside, and that becomes unmanageable. A friend of mine was telling me a story recently about a veteran friend of his who has a medal from a combat operation that he can never wear and he can never show anyone because we were not there. You know, it was a country that we were not in. And so that is just something that he keeps inside of him and can't discuss.
Because there's such a language and a culture, I know I personally, even though I've worked with Vietnam vets, I often feel like, gosh, there's got to be someone better for them who really understands more. And yet I've always gotten, at least in my private work, the equine-assisted learning and so on, I've always had people come to me. But I think this is a really interesting point for all of us because there is that, I think there's a perception that, you know, maybe we just don't know enough to help or to know or to, you know, create that rapport.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point. It's worth more conversation, and it's why in the workshop that I'm doing with a colleague in May, we have a whole section on military cultural competence because certain things are important to this population.
Yeah.
They do need to know that we understand certain things about them. And that really is important.
Right.
And so we're adding a piece of our workshop that will address that and help people get a little bit more familiar with language and, you know, rank and branches of service and all of that and why it matters to people because they have a tremendous amount of pride in what they're doing. But this other piece of being able to listen, you know, for the story, listen for the narrative, and be able to sit in, you know, in non-judgmental, in a presence.
Or outside.
That's non-
yeah, even, sorry, I got excited. Go ahead. That's non.
No. You know, you exactly get it. I mean, it's being a non-judgmental presence that can take in the horror that they need to get outside of themselves, because otherwise I think it's an impediment to healing. These things do need to be said at some point, and they need to be said to somebody who can take it in without collapsing in the presence of it. And I think a lot of civilians have a hard time listening to what we have sent these people to do. So let me just tell you one piece, which is there's a guy, Bob Rowe, who runs an organization in California, and I had the privilege of being on a panel with him about moral injury a couple years ago in New York City. And one of the things that he has said, this quote, and I think he's spot on, he says, his name is Joseph Barbara. He says, this is a quote, "What we cannot acknowledge, we cannot process. What we cannot process, we cannot transform. What we cannot transform haunts us."
Yeah.
It's beautiful. And like with no evidence to support this, I think that the, you know, suicides among special forces is about the stuff that they are never allowed to tell anybody. They certainly don't tell their family members because they don't want to inflict that level of trauma on a loved one. But they also don't know that there are people in the civilian world who can listen to these stories and not, you know, pass out from hearing them. But we have to be able to listen and sit without judgment and with compassion. So,
Eva, there's so much that you've just mentioned, I think. If you, do you mind if we unpack a bit of this for a minute?
Sure.
I know we've got other parts to go into.
Sure.
So I want to go back just a second to the culture and the fact that being outside the sort of military perspective or culture even, the key to that you said is about non-judgmental, but I think also it's almost the relief of being outside the culture itself, because the culture is going to require or have this need for people to be able to go back into combat once if you're in that culture. So I think that it might almost be a key to be able to open up, to be outside that culture, to talk to someone outside that culture for some people, maybe not always. Then there's a conversation you and I had earlier when we were planning this talk about part of what society has done, since PTSD was just sort of given that title, and what happened with maybe Vietnam vets when they came back, there was a lot of shaming, you know, a lot of blaming by the society, and that was traumatic. But what we did in response a lot of times was to say thank you for your service and sort of make sure we celebrate the hero. And in some ways, that's almost as shallow a response as the previous response. It's still not really seeing that person for who they are and what they've been asked to do. It's still almost protecting the civilian from this in the same way that this person might feel they need to protect their family members from what they've done, because it's just a traumatic experience just to know what you've done.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful way to put it, that it protects the civilian from really knowing what we've asked these people to do. Because some of the veterans that, you know, have had a really rather violent response to thank you for your service have said, if you knew what I did, trust me, you wouldn't be thanking me.
You wouldn't be thanking me.
So I think it's a further wounding, you know, to keep using that accolade, which you're right, it makes us feel a little better, but it doesn't help them. You know, simply, I'm glad you're home. You know, thank you.
It's a glossing over to some degree, yeah.
Very complex subject that you've taken on here.
Okay.
Well, me too.
Why don't we go ahead and talk a little bit about what are some of the symptoms people might see in a, you know, as they're working with the horses in a session, things that we can look for that would help us identify that this person might be dealing with moral injury?
Sure. I think it's a great question. Well, one of the programs that we really got this on in a very clear way, it was a few years ago. It was a group session because we like to work with groups of military veterans and we work with a herd of horses at Liberty. And so it gives them a real opportunity to interact and to eventually form one large herd. But in the process, you know, there's a lot of things that happen just as members of the horse herd are, you know, figuring out their role while the human herd is doing the same thing and the human horse herd is doing the same thing. So everybody's figuring out what is my place here. And so a couple of years ago, we had a program with three of the veterans who were in the program. They were actually active duty still. They had had recent suicide attempts, and they were brought in by command in uniform here. We'll be back in a week. And so we had three, you know, very at-risk people in this program, others who had had previous suicide attempts as well, but these were three very at-risk people. And one of them had sort of decompensated during the week in that he wasn't speaking, he wasn't eating, EMDR was not going well. We were very concerned about him in particular, and we case-conferenced him a lot. And so my partner, I was working with Alejandro Lara, who I'm still working with, And we decided, he was having a private session in the arena, we just decided, look, we don't have much more time with him, we need to move in and be really direct. So he came into the arena, there were a few horses, and he had an experience where he approached a horse that was lying down that did not get up. And we both expected this horse to just pop right up as this guy approached, but he just stayed laying on the ground. The man, you know, put his hand under the horse's head and held him and sat there and cried. And so when he got up from that, and the other horses were right there, but this horse did not move. And it was very powerful because we knew this horse had had a recent trauma and had gotten his legs tangled when he was being tacked. He'd gotten his legs tangled in some lead lines, and so he couldn't let anybody go near his feet or legs and you know, his hooves. And so we just expected him to pop up when he was in that kind of vulnerable position, and he didn't. And the warrior was very taken aback by that, and we talked to him a little bit about it. And we said, look, you know, we know you're really struggling, that there's a part of you that wants to die still. And so we want to figure out the part of you that wants to live also and see if we can work with that part. I work with parts a lot in my clinical work. And so he was able to identify the horse as the part of him that he referred to as life. That's life. That's the metaphor he used. And he spent some time in the arena with life. And toward the end of the session, we were processing with him verbally, and we asked him, and they had been in the middle of the arena, and he was again in tears, and we gave him a lot of space to do whatever he needed to do. This was more that had come out of him in the last 4 days. And so when we asked him what was happening, he said, well, you know, I was walking around with life, but now that I'm in the middle of the arena with life, I can see all around me, and I see that I have some options. And I didn't know that before. So, yes, we were like, okay, good. You know, a little bit has happened here. You know, we were working with the shift that had occurred with him. But then the next morning, all the warriors, maybe about 8 of them, were in the arena with 4 or 5 horses. And they had something they were working on. We were having them learn how to move the herd without talking, without touching, you know, as one group, just see if you can physically move from one part of the arena to the other. And they got all excited. They finally were able to do this in a way that they liked, because, as you know, when we give people an activity or a task, we don't care about outcome. We're more interested in what happens as they're making the effort and problem solving. And so, you know, the dynamic of that. And so they got all excited because they had moved the horses and they were feeling good. And there was a large Pilates ball in the arena, and they started kicking it back and forth between each other. And it went really high, hit the rafters, made a big noise, and all the horses bolted. And they ran right to the door to get out of the arena, and they just stood there facing the door like, I'm done. I've had it. And the guy from the session the day before said, I'm not, he just exploded. I'm not doing this. Stop. This is bullying. This is what happens to us. I'm not doing this. We're hurting them. We're frightening them. I'm done. I'm out. And he didn't leave. He just, you know, said this, and several other of the warriors said, yeah, man, you're right. We're not doing this. Let's stop. And so Allie and I looked at each other and we said, come here, let's circle up. Okay, here it is. You know, we've been talking about moral injury, and moral injury at war, you can't undo, you can't repair if you've killed someone or completely, you know, devastated a village or a family or whatever. And right here, something has just happened, and you have the opportunity as a group to repair this. So we're giving you an opportunity to do what you need to do together with them to repair what just happened. And, you know, we weren't being judgmental. They hadn't done anything harmful to the horses, but they were experiencing it as, whoa, we do not want to behave this way anymore. This is the whole thing of, you know, coming.
It's such an act of answering what he saw the day before, where he said there's more options in life. You know, I see there are more options now. So in some ways,
that's right.
It's like the next day he's now it's so in his body that he is actually saying no to the options that are diminishing and working to repair now.
Exactly. He moved forward. That's where the movement is such a beautiful part of this work, that he moved, he did a shift inside of himself, and he led a group where he had been really outside of things. He hadn't been talking at all, not to anyone. He took leadership. He said no, and he helped lead the repair that happened. And the repair that happened, we gave them whatever you all need to do, and do it in silence, let us know when you're done. And they walked over, and they very quietly soothed the horses. Yeah, each person went to each horse, and they were petting them, and they were being very gentle. And then they ended up in a semicircle. They decided not to move the horses anywhere, leave them where they were. They were still a little bit facing out toward the outside of the arena. And they formed a semicircle around the horses, but including the horses, and they held hands. And we went over and asked if we could do a loving-kindness meditation with them, and they said, yep. And so we did loving-kindness for a few minutes with them and with the horses. And then we suggested that, you know, life is not always like this. You know, there's going to be other stuff that happens. So we invited them to go create an area of, you know, disruption and unsafety in the arena. And the horses went with them as they did something else, another activity. The horses went right with them. And so, you know, this is the work that we're hoping to really put out and help other people learn to notice what happens, name it, because naming is really important. Naming what just happened and then giving the opportunity to shift and then allow memory to reconsolidate, because that's the other piece of trauma resolution, is that memory has to reconsolidate, but you also have to do that as an active, thoughtful process where you actually know what you're doing. You know, not just, well, you know, see you next week, or, you know, whatever, but actually let people integrate and process that material and talk about it.
Your example shows is how much he integrated so that it was instinctual. It's not like he planned to say that. It was an instinctual shift. This is the value of experiential learning, period, you know. That move yes. he made was an instinct that was answering the call of life, you know. I think that's what's beautiful about what you've just described. And then not only that, but then they all got to make that move. So you can really see that integrating of the learning from that key moment from the day before.
Exactly. And, you know, I don't know what it would have been like if we hadn't said to him at the beginning of his individual session, hey, you know, we know you're struggling with whether you want to stay alive or not, and we want to side with the part of you that wants to live. So let's figure that out here. And he went with it. You know, he didn't know what we were talking about, but he says, ma'am, I know you're talking about metaphor, but I'm in.
It wasn't metaphor by the second day.
Exactly. It became a real living, breathing, larger herd that had developed out of what happened to him and what he got. You know, it's the experience that's critical, but it's also that he was able to make meaning of it. Because that's the other piece that has to happen for memory to reconsolidate.
Well, and we're not, this isn't the topic of this talk, but just briefly, we could mention that there's a lot of things you guys could have done as facilitators, either differently or, you know, inadvertently, that would have changed the setting. So, you know, because you knew that horse had problems with its, you know, with its legs, you could have wanted to keep him safe and keep him away from the horse when it's down. And, you know, what do you want to say? Is there anything you might want to say, even though this isn't your main topic right now, about that facilitation moment and what's key in this kind of moral injury sort of framework?
I love the question. I do. I think what's key is that for people, you know, I don't want to suggest that I'm a suicide expert. I don't think I am, you know, even still. But I think that for people,
people need to find their way back in a way that works for them. And I think that our capacity, me and Alejandra's capacity to stand back and let that unfold, and we didn't know, you know, whatever's going to happen is going to happen, but, you know, our way of working with safety in the arena is different than maybe in some practices, because, you know, we want to let people have their own experience and figure out their own boundaries. You know, am I putting myself in danger? How am I going to figure that out? Because if we do everything for people, they don't learn it on their own. And then we've actually contaminated their process.
It's a nice illustration of the Igala's untraining idea, where you are standing back more. And then it's also, I also think of Barbara Rector, who has the words allow, allow, allow. But as a facilitation, just sort of general move, this magic couldn't have happened if you guys had put some of these concepts like, oh, we need to protect him or something, as part of your job, into your, you know, into action.
I think learning to not do too much, because that often gets in people's ways. And so allowing the process to unfold. Yeah, I love some of the things that Barbara Rector has taught. Allowing it to unfold, allowing it to be, allowing him to find his way, you know, rather than penalizing him for having hurt himself. You know, here we are in a very large arena saying, this is your time, man. You know, figure out what you need to do, and we are right here with you. And I think also when I told the story to Joe Bobro, it was one of the things I presented at the panel on moral injury. And he, after the panel, said to me in front of the entire audience, I'm so touched by how you let him just be there in his grief and didn't move in. That's just exactly what we need to do. And so, you know, I think that's also, you know, my training and our training. And, of course, it is part of Igala's premise that people have to make these, they have to figure these things out on their own. And
right.
That's the beauty of healing, is making your own internal decision to stay alive without somebody, you know, forcing it on you or, you know, criticizing you for having these thoughts. And it's very complex, but if people don't decide on their own, then it's not real. That's why we have, you know, the unfortunate statistic of people killing themselves after a psych admission. You know, they get out and the suicide rate goes way up. And, you know, that's partly because there are all these rules and structures and people telling them what to do, and they haven't actually made the decision on their own. And all that, you know, time that could have been given to that, you know, is now gone. So, and I think there's also a lot to be said for movement, because people have to be able to allow all of the trauma that lives in their nervous system to dissipate out, and movement facilitates that.
Yeah, I want to get to existentialism, but I do want to point one thing that came back that I remember I had when you first gave the quote. Now I've forgotten the man's name, but where he talked about, without being able to talk about it, you can't fully experience it. Without fully experiencing it, you can't transform it. I mean, this has been a great illustration of that. It's also a key about narrative, you know, story. So, you know, a lot of people say it's just story, it's only story, but really what happened was that horse brought up the story that was the sort of place where the pain and the injury was, it sounds like. So the horse being on the ground and him putting its head in his lap is really a reliving or an experience of that story again. And the story, really being able to tell it and process it, is what leads to the transformation. And, you know, I was an English professor and all of that. I work with story all the time, but I always tell people, well, the problem isn't story, it's a story fragment. It's a story that doesn't come to denouement, you know, the transformational moment where you have a new understanding of the whole experience, that transformation hasn't yet happened. So I love how you've illustrated that, and a lot of what you've been talking about just got crystal clear with those examples.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Let's talk about existentialism, and maybe we can start with having you define what that means, and existential phenomenology as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think existentialism is really about life issues. You know, it's really looking at life as it presents itself, and phenomenology is seeing things as they are without interpretation, which is very much what we do. You know, we learned that from our horse friends, what it is, right? And so the existential phenomenological approach to psychology really is a very precise method in a way. It's also very expansive, that seeks to develop a really deep and embodied understanding of human existence. That's really what it's about. You know, that it's a challenge to more rigid psychology schools and their views of human beings, and that existentialism and existential phenomenology is really looking into the richness and diversity of human psychological experience and an ethical approach, and that it recognizes that the fundamental characteristic of being human is to be responsible to others. And so it takes us out of the realm of the individual as an isolated island and puts us back into a relationship.
Hmm.
One of the things I learned from one of my professors in my master's program in existential phenomenology, we were talking a lot about behaviorism and psychoanalysis and all these different things, and they finally said, you know, what it really comes down to is the person of the therapist and what happens in the space between them and their client. And it doesn't matter what you've been trained in if you can do that. And I think that's very much what we do in the arena, is allow for that, you know, space between, you know, horse therapist and human client and the facilitators stay out but move in. You know, it's the spaciousness that is allowed to develop, and that meaning comes from within that, irrespective of what our, you know, our previous training is and what we think we're supposed to be doing. We have to learn to listen and to see.
Right. That's nice. I like that. That's going to be, I think that's a, why don't you talk about that a little bit more? Maybe in context of the concept of, you know, when a client comes to us, they may have a diagnosis, you know, that's usually going to be some kind of pathology with a series of symptoms. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I was trained in that program and that stayed with me all these years is to not look at diagnosis. And so this was difficult when I first worked at an agency, because there was a requirement to do an intake and I was supposed to read the chart. And I really resisted that, and I tried to not do it, because as soon as you've looked at a chart and you have a diagnosis in front of you, you're going to see the patient differently. Or you're going to, you know, you have preconceptions. You can't not. You know, we're human. Somebody comes in and says, this person is, you know, is depressed. Then you see them in a certain way. And if you don't have that language in front of you, you see who's sitting there, and you might see something completely different. So I really try to put these things out of my head when I'm working with somebody. And I have the luxury of being in private practice, so I can pretty much do what I want. You know, I resent that I have to put a diagnosis on an insurance form, and I rarely take insurance. But it's really a conceptual difference of, you know, what I look for is very different. I look for how the person is making eye contact or not, how they're sitting. Are they in their spine? You know, and part of this is from my yoga training, and part of this is from sensory motor psychotherapy. I'm looking for how they hold themselves, how they move, how what expressions are coming through the body, irrespective of what the words are. So it's learning to turn off the words and watch and observe and check in with yourself in this person's presence, what's happening within me, because that, you know, most of us were trained in a more psychoanalytic view of transference and countertransference, and the sensory motor world has a very different way of looking at that, that we learn what's happening with our client by the way we feel inside when we're with them. And so, and that's the clue. That's countertransference in a really positive way. It's information. It's not judgment.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I remember a client that I had that he came and said, you know, he was eager to talk about all that was going on because he'd been all over the world really looking for help, and he traveled a lot for his job and everything. But anyway, one of the things he said was, I know I'm a narcissist. I've been diagnosed as a narcissist. And the advice I've been given is when I start getting really focused on myself, you know, to focus out on to the others. And what the horses showed was that he was in grief. And whether or not he actually is a narcissist was secondary to the fact that what he really needed to do was focus on himself and take care of himself in that moment, self-compassion. So the advice they've been giving him was making him further in crisis. If you watch what the horses are doing, they weren't showing that he was over-focused. They were showing that he needed to take care more of what was going on inside.
Yeah, that what they were saying to him was actually further wounding him and not allowing him to heal.
Yeah, it was preventing
the healing. Exactly. I mean, most of our diagnostic terms are really pejorative. I mean, there's not much nice about them. You know, we don't have a quote-unquote diagnosis for somebody who's compassionate and gives of themselves. And, you know, I mean, it's just...
Compassion fatigue, maybe, but yeah. Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that we have to, you know, learn to see what's in front of us without preconception, because as soon as we, you know, have this idea that we know what's going on, we're probably missing something really important. And that's what was the hardest thing for me to learn. I kind of knew it intuitively, but, you know, because of some traditional training I had when I was young in psychology, it just, you know, like, you're not supposed to do that. But intuitively, I'm usually right. And so when I've allowed myself to get back to that, use my own perception, you know, what I'm seeing is probably close to what's happening. I can check it out. But this whole idea of being right, I think, throws people off, because it then really, you're seeing things through such a dim lens instead of an expansive one, like, wow, there's really a lot happening here.
Yeah, I think this also goes back to really trusting your horses more than any piece of paper that came with this person, or a diagnosis that came with the person.
That's one of my favorite experiences. I was working with an equine specialist. We were waiting for a group of military veterans to come into the arena, and the equine person said, you know, one of these people has a really high rank. What do you think we should do with that? And I said, well, do you think the horses know her rank? Like, nothing. We'll just see how it plays out. And in that session, she was not the leader who emerged. Somebody else did. So, yeah, I think horses have the key, and, you know, we need to pay attention to them and their wisdom.
So an existential crisis, in my perspective from literature again, it's often about alienation or isolation from society, even though you're in the middle of society often. That's sort of what you think about with that from a sort of philosophical, literary perspective. If we're talking about this context, I mean, is there anything else you'd want to say about the existential crisis we might find our clients in, or maybe we might be looking for as we see what the horses are saying? Or maybe that, I guess I'm saying, is this the framework that we might want to, that might be more useful to us when we're looking at what we're seeing rather than a diagnosis?
I would say yes. I mean, that's my short answer. It's something that I've used my whole career. I still have notes from my psychology master's program. And you know, the four basic themes in existentialism, some people say there are more than four, but the ones that I understand to be the four critical themes are about death, fear of death, or, you know, one's view of death, freedom, which is the contrast between our own individual will and then our responsibility. The, you know, questions of freedom and responsibility, questions of isolation, and questions of meaninglessness. And I think if we look at the human condition as being in one or more of those instead of depression or schizophrenia, you know, that doesn't tell me anything about the human being in front of me. And I think when we start to look thematically at what is really happening here and what is the expression of it, or what is the person's behavior expressing? What does it mean? What is the information they're trying to convey to us that has nothing to do with language, you know, with spoken language? It's the language of the body, and it's the language of movement and all of those other things. It gives us a much richer view of humanness. And even with the most difficult clients, we can always, if we're looking from that lens, we can always find something to connect to.
Yeah, rather than someone who comes in with a diagnosis that we, you know, that means something to me and I'm not going to be able to relate to this client.
Well, that doesn't help.
Yeah, I think this is key. I mean, this story just keeps coming up to me. So if you don't mind bearing with one more story from me. When I was in undergrad, I had a psych class where we were practicing diagnoses. And we were watching movies, a particular movie that was assigned, and then diagnosing, you know, the particular character assigned. Well, when I made my analysis of it, I said, I think this character could be diagnosed as such and such. But then the rest of my paper, I argued for why actually considering their environment and their inner world and so on, actually a very human and natural response and therefore couldn't be diagnosed as a disorder. What she was looking for me to do was isolate the diagnosis. And what I was doing was saying, you can't do that, you know? And so anything you want to say to that?
Yeah, I think it's much more profoundly, you know, accurate for who people are and what being alive is about. It's a very complex situation. And I think, you know, diagnoses, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but the literal meaning is to know twice over. And so there's a reason to really explore, like, what we think is going on here. But the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, that's for insurance companies. That's why it was developed. It has nothing to do with treatment or with caring for human beings. It was to codify for insurance companies. And so I think we've, you know, adopted this language as if it means something. It means very little. You know,
yeah,
just calling somebody depressed has, how does that help?
Yeah, and right? I mean, I know there's some invaluable things about that with helping with methodology. And at the same time, I think there's also some value in seeing that that person's situation, they were actually doing the best they could considering everything. So there's still this sort of sense of heroism is what always comes to mind for me, the hero's journey that's still going on even while this person might be diagnosed something.
I totally agree with you, and there's some tenets that, you know, have stayed with me from my my schooling. And, you know, one I mentioned before, which is that all behavior has meaning, and it's our job to figure out the meaning of that behavior. But the other thing is that all behavior is contextual. So, you know, when we give someone a diagnosis, we're suggesting that this is them 24/7, and that's never the case. You know, there are people who are quite different in different situations. Harris Deck Sullivan said it the best. He was an analyst who, I believe he was a student of Freud, and he said it the best when he was being interviewed by somebody, and he said, well, my schizophrenic patients are not schizophrenic with me.
Oh. Yeah, I like that.
So fits into the work we do with horses because it gives us a much more expansive perspective, right?
Yes. There's a lot of help with seeing what's going on with what the horses give us.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of healing that I still think is, at least from science perspective, a mystery of what's happening with the horse. I don't think we fully captured that yet in, you know, our description, which is great.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the beauty of it is, you know, can it be okay to not know?
On that very perfect moment, I hate to even say anything else, but let's talk about the offerings that you have going on this year that people can, you know, get some training with you from and just know that you're doing.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. So May 4th and 5th, Alejandra and I are doing a workshop in Warwick, New York, and it's called All the Way Home, Healing Our Nation's Veterans Through the Power of the Herd. So we're going to be doing very hands-on work in the arena with the participants who come to that workshop that we're hoping will be a mixture of mental health professionals and equine specialists and some military veterans that have been invited. And there will be some classroom, some didactics about military cultural competence and some of the themes that we're going to be working with. You know, what is moral injury? How do we distinguish it? All of that. And then at your symposium, we will do a condensed version of that. You know, we'll pull out the salient features to do a half-day workshop at your symposium.
I'd like to extend an invitation to join us in person in the Ogden Mountain Valley, just outside of Salt Lake City, Utah, for the 2019 Healing with Horse Symposium, May 31st to June 2nd. Pre- and post-conference workshops make for a week-long set of offerings from May 29th to June 4th. And Eva and Alejandra, as Eva just mentioned, are presenting on Friday, just before the conference begins, in a half-day workshop. More information about the symposium is on the site healingwithhorse.org. And if you enjoyed today's session, the series of the 2019 Healing with Horse Telesummit is available for purchase and download at healingwithhorse.org. And Eva, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think your questions were really powerful, and I don't think so. I guess my last little, you know, words of wisdom for people doing this work would be just to look and listen for the implicit. You know, to start getting a little more comfortable with not knowing and try to see what's presenting itself to you.
Okay, that is it for now. Thank you for being part of the Healing Forces of the World. Bye now.